public and legal personnel. We would first like to have the RAC members introduce themselves. And we can start down here with Kim.
Ken Strong, Sportsman's Rep.
Dan Potts, non-consumptive rep.
Ben Lauder, at large.
Ron Camp, Sportsman's Rep.
Chris Marvel, at large.
Carl Hurst, Sportsman.
Alan White, Agriculture.
Okay, and I'd like to excuse Larry Fitzgerald. He said that he's hauling water to his cows up on the Wasatch and also the elk up there. He was trying to get some help. Anyway, and George Garcia, he's out working on the fire that's out of Vernon. It's the committee out there. And Christine Smith is also excused. We also have Jason Vernon here, the director of the Central Region. We'd like to recognize Jenny and our new accomplice here is Debbie Meekum. She'll be taking the minutes of the meeting, so we welcome you and look forward to having her with us. The procedure will go as follows. The division will make a presentation that will be followed by questions from the RAC concerning that. Then the public will be given an opportunity to ask questions about the presentation. Then the public will then be able to make comments concerning the presentation, and then it'll be brought back to the RAC. Individuals will have 3 minutes, and we'll invoke the John Bear rule. And that is, groups will also have 3 minutes to present their agenda and their comments. If you have a comment, make sure that you fill out a yellow card, and we'll call you up to the mic for that particular item. We need to then move forward, and let's have an approval of the agenda minutes. Has everyone had a chance to see the minutes of the last meeting and any changes or corrections that you see are necessary? Okay, we'll entertain a motion on that.
I'll make the motion, we accept.
Okay.
I'll second it.
Ron with the second to approve the agenda and the minutes of the last meeting. The Wildlife Board meeting was held last Thursday. I had the opportunity to attend that, so I'll kind of give you a brief summary of what occurred there. Yeah, I think we better vote on that motion, I'm sorry. All approved? Any against? Okay. Voting is unanimous. I do that too often. Okay. The last Wildlife Board meeting dealt with several items. The fur bearer rule amendments was proposed by the division was voted on, and that vote was unanimous by the Wildlife Board. The bobcat management plan was also voted on unanimously to accept the division's recommendations proposed. The fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendation was also accepted and voted unanimously. The cougar recommendation and rule amendment for the coming year was presented. Our RAC voted 7-2 to approve that. There was a lot of discussion on this particular item. There's a lot of public there concerning this. Some were against cougar hunting, period. Some were in favor of hunting, but were against cougar hunting. The board voted to raise the number of cougar permits on the Boulder unit from 11 to 14, and to raise the number of cougar permits on the Fish Lake unit from 12 to 16. That vote was 5-4-1 against. So that passed 5-1. On the Southwest Manti, the proposal was made to increase the permits from 5 to 8 permits, and that also passed 5-1. They also put on an action log item with that to study the feasibility of doing a online or a type of course that would require anyone that drew a cougar permit to be able to know exactly the identification, whether what's sex that cougar was, so that they could make a decision as to whether they wanted to do it. So they're going to look at that. And then the balance of the motion, or the balance of the presentation by the division, was voted on, and that was unanimous. The proposed fee schedule, we had made a motion to change the fee proposal for a youth turkey permit from $25 to $15, and that passed RAC 6-3. The Wildlife Board did not pass that particular proposal. We also to accept the remainder of the recommendation presented by the division, passed RAC unanimously, and the Wildlife Board also passed that unanimously. That's there were some other items that were not something that we dealt with, but just quickly, there was they had the expo permit audit, and they went through that, and the action was to accept that audit of the expo permit allocation and audit unanimously. They also voted to accept and be part of the Blue Ribbon Council a letter of support for that particular item, to support that transferring, I think it was about $1.3 billion into that fund from another other source that was available, so that that could be used for that Blue Ribbon Council. There was also a proposal to modify to the mentor program. That was so that on the mentoring program, rather, you didn't have to be related or have legal custody to mentor a youth into that program, so they could use your tag to hunt. But that has to be done legislatively, and so they voted unanimously to begin that process to see if the legislature and those that proposed that bill originally could support that action.
So, Richard?
Yes, sir.
Point of clarification. If I understand it, that never went through the RAC, so I'm just curious. So the Wildlife Board voted to send that to the legislature and try to get that passed through the legislature, at which point it would come back.
It would have to come back through the RAC process.
Right.
And then through the Wildlife Board again. That was just to begin the process of putting that in motion.
Okay. So, thanks.
They also brought up use of public hunters to aid in deer research, and this is on the Ponsagon. Evidently on the Ponsagon there's some problem with cactus bucks. They mentioned that there in one canyon on the Ponsagon there were 20 bucks that they observed that had cactus head. Never lose the velvet, you know what I'm talking about. And they want to do a study, and they have amber deformities, and they're going to issue 5 permits from September 29th to October 1st, and five more permits from November 2nd to 6th. And they have to buy a tag to do that. And that will come out of the depredation pool, and they have to go with a division personnel to hunt those bucks. And then we're going to use some tissue from them to try to determine why that's happening, because they say that's becoming a real problem. So that'll be interesting to see how this turns out.
This fall?
Yeah.
How are they going to distribute that?
It comes out of the depredation pool. Jason, maybe you can, if you know more than I do, but the way I understood it was that if you've already got a tag for a deer, you can't get one of these tags. This has to come out of folks that don't have tags. They can get their names in the depredation pool, and then they'll pull them out, and they can have a tag and go with them and make that study. Does that sound right? Okay, thank you. Okay, I think that's it. We'll move on to the next agenda item, and Jason Burton will give us a regional update.
All right, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things before we get into our action items. From our wildlife side, our biologists have been finalizing the elk management plans, which will be presented to the RAC in November. And then to the December board meeting, presentations will be made there. They've been working hard on those plans, and they're getting those finalized right now. Excuse me. Reports are coming in, and it looks like it's going to be a good chukar hunting year. They flew out across there, and for the second year in a row, they've seen high densities of chukars across the landscape. There will be some pen-raised birds also released. And as in the past with the pheasants and with the chuckers, there'll be information online with those maps, the updated maps showing exactly where those birds have been released. One thing just to note is on September 17th will be the youth hunt scheduled for that day. And then the regular season for chuckers opens the following weekend on the 24th. And then reports coming in from hunters kind of follow what we had kind of anticipated for the archery hunt. They're seeing a lot more bucks out in the field this year. So that's encouraging and exciting for the hunters as well. And that's kind of what we anticipated and predicted as we spoke about in our last RAC meeting. For our habitat section, there's quite a few wildfires going out in the central region right now that they're keeping an eye on. You've probably seen the most recent one, the West Government Creek, over to the west of Vernon area there. They've got it about 80 to 90%, I think I saw the other day, under control. It's burned just over 4,000 acres. A lot of those acres are in sage grouse habitat, so it's high priority for the division to go in and cooperate with the land managers to rehabilitate and restore those. So we'll be spending a lot of time on that fire. A couple of the other bigger ones, larger ones in the Central region, the Cedar Fire, just kind of north and west of Dugway on the Cedar Mountains, about 1,200 acres. And one on the south end of the Sheep Rocks called the North Moor Fire is about 1,400 acres. So our habitat section, spending time with the BLM, with Dugway, with the Forest Service, coming up with some restoration strategies for those fires. They have placed three guzzlers on Lake Mountain there, west of Utah Lake. And in the next couple weeks, they're going to be putting another three or four guzzlers out there as well. From our outreach section, we have Kokanee Salmon Viewing Day is coming up. It's scheduled for September 17th, a Saturday. From 9 to 3 o'clock up at the Visitor Center there at Strawberry. They're finishing a brand new boardwalk up there. They're putting it in place right now, actually. That'll kind of, if you've been up there, it wraps you around and takes you to the fish trap into the bait-taking facility there. So hopefully by the time that comes, we'll have a brand new boardwalk in place. Lots of visitors. If you haven't seen those Kokanee there, I highly suggest you get up there and look at those. It's quite a sight to see that. From our aquatics, I think there's been quite a bit of information and news concerning Tittle Fork, the American Fork Canyon sedimentation and some fish kill in there. From Tittle Fork Reservoir, where they're doing the construction on, they've drained the reservoir, and as they drain the reservoir, their sediment in the bottom was washed down the creek. They anticipated some sediment coming down, but not the amount that actually ended up going down. That sediment does have some levels of lead and cadmium, mercury, and things in there, heavy metals that are toxic. We did find a fish kill from the dam to the confluence of North Fork and of the American Fork and the American Fork River. It's about 2 miles. And then below that confluence, we saw that fish kill lessen and to where we found about 4 miles below that, the fish were in okay shape. To decrease the sedimentation of that, they built a bypass channel, a canal around the sediment. And they're dumping the creek into that canal and then dumping it back into the river, so the sediment's not getting back into the river at this point. And it's dramatically, drastically cleared up the rivers. They have put caution signs up along the creeks for people. They discourage them wading and walking in the creek and the sediment. And as a division, we've encouraged catch and release on that river at this point. Our crews just wrapped up a 10-day effort partnering with Utah State University, seine monitoring to track changes in carp populations in Utah Lake, kind of looking also at the success of removal efforts of the carp from the lake. I think you've probably seen Facebook and the news, they stocked 25,000 wipers in the Jordanelle Reservoir at the end of August. So that was pretty exciting to get those fish in there. We've had a lot of good comments concerning that stocking and happy anglers to be, I think, coming up in the future years. And then one thing that's coming up in the next week, I guess, kind of a big deal for us, is the final roadrunner treatment for Mill Creek. Last year they treated the final reach there, about 3 miles. They'll be treating it again, the same stretch this year, just to make sure all the fish are out of there entirely to get an entire removal from that. I think the bulk of that will happen next Tuesday on September 13th, but they'll be working throughout the week to make that final. And Mr. Chairman, I think that's all I have for updates. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions from the board or comments?
I have one quick question. What's the mussel status in Deer Creek right now? Where are we at with that?
Man, that is a good question. I'm not sure I have an answer on Chris or Mike. Can you help me with that?
We did dive it earlier in the year and found no signs of aquatics. So I believe that's 2 out of the last 2 years that it's come up free. So we need one more year, as I understand it, until it's off the list.
All right. Thank you.
Let me add to that, we will be diving it again this fall as well.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you. Okay, we'll go to our first action item then. It's a 2017-18 fishing guidebook and rule, R657-13. Randy Holtlinger, the Cold Water Sports Fishing Program Coordinator. Come up and
thank you. Okay, thanks, Mr. Chairman. My name is Randy Opplinger. I'm the new cold water sport fisheries coordinator for the Division of Wildlife, replacing Paul Birdsey, who retired earlier this year. Also in attendance tonight, we got Craig Walker down in the front corner, who's the new warm water sport fish coordinator with the Division. And also we have our Central Region Aquatics Manager, Chris Crockett. He can answer any questions pertaining to real specific issues within the region. Really, there's kind of a few things I want to talk about as part of my presentation tonight. The first part, I'm going to start with some just information-only items, just talking about some upcoming changes that we have within the aquatics section. And then I'm going to switch gears and I'm going to talk about proposed regulation changes. And as I talk about those proposed changes, I'm going to talk kind of intertwine into that the results of an angler survey that we did, and I'm going to kind of talk about how those results provide evidence of angler support for some of the regulation changes that we're proposing. But the first thing I'm going to start with are just some information-only items. And the first one is we're in the aquatic section with our fisheries guidebook. We're actually going to switch to a two-year release cycle for that guidebook. So the upcoming guidebook that we put out, it's going to be valid for both 2017 and 2018. And there's a couple reasons why we're going to do that. The first one is just to help the public out when we do frequent rule changes and release a guidebook every year. We think that sometimes it kind of confuses people. They have trouble tracking all the changes that we put in place. And we think that going to a two-year release cycle is just going to help people out, help them just understand the regulations a little bit better within an area. And on top of that, going to a two-year cycle is going to benefit us as biologists within the division. And really, some of the reasons for that is it just gives us 2 years to consider any regulation changes, look at the science, look at public support behind those regulations, just to make sure they're well supported before we enact them. The release cycle for the guidebook we put out this year is going to be in sync with Arizona. Hopefully it's going to be in sync with Wyoming as well. And what that's going to do is it's going to be very helpful for anglers that use Lake Powell and Flaming Gorge, because those two reservoirs straddle state boundaries. And it's going to just minimize the number of regulation changes that anglers experience on those waters and should help simplify things and make it easier for those anglers. The next thing with tiger muskie, we've kind of started to explore maybe a suite of management changes and regulation changes with tiger muskie. We're not proposing anything right now, but there's a good chance when we release a new guidebook in a couple of years that we might be proposing some changes in how we regulate tiger muskie. Next off, in the last year, we released two management plans for Flaming Gorge Reservoir and Jordan L Reservoir. I'm going to go over the Flaming Gorge one real fast. I'm just going to go through this real fast. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but our management objectives at Flaming Gorge, based on the plan that we released, are for rainbow trout. We're hoping to see in our gill nets that we set each year to see at least 0.35 fish per hour show up in those nets. For lake trout, we'd like to see Flaming Gorge really be kind of a destination trophy lake trout fishery. And we put exploratory nets out to help gauge the lake trout population of the lake. We're hoping to collect greater than 1.5 fish that are greater than 28 inches in length per hour in those nets. Also, within Flaming Gorge, we have burbot in that lake. Those fish were illegally introduced, and we want to keep that population in check and make sure they don't explode within that reservoir. So we're hoping to collect at least one burbot per hour within our gill nets. Also, we'd like to maintain a healthy kokanee salmon population within Flaming Gorge, so we're hoping to find a population of at least 600,000 fish that are between 0 and 2 years old. And then finally, we'd also like to prevent any kind of illegal or invasive species introductions into the reservoir. Now, as I alluded to earlier, we also released a new plan for Jordan L Reservoir. I'm going to be pretty brief on this. Chris Crockett, the regional manager, is going to talk about this in a little more detail later tonight. But really, our management objectives at Jordan L is, first off, we want to just enrich trophy angling opportunities in that reservoir. I think many people heard in last year we put both tiger muskie and wiper in the reservoir, and that helps us move toward that goal. We're also trying to promote Jordan L as a family fishery. Jordan L is obviously very close to Salt Lake City, so it's an easy place for people to go just for an afternoon to go fishing, and it's a great family opportunity. We like to promote it as such. Also, on top of that, because it's so close to Salt Lake, there's a lot of boaters that use Jordan L Reservoir. They're not all anglers. There's personal watercraft users, water skiers, etc. And we want to make sure that we have a quality recreational experience for all users on the water of Jordan L. We'd also like to manage Jordan L's fishery for compatibility with native species management. And we'd also like to manage Jordan L's destination fishery, so a place that people really want to go to if they want to have quality time catching fish. And then finally, we want to ensure that no new species are legally moved into or out of Jordan L Reservoir. Okay, so I'm going to shift gears a little. That's it for the informational stuff. And I'm going to move forward. I'm going to talk about the proposed regulation changes that we have for the upcoming guidebook that we're going to put out this year. As I talk about these proposed regulation changes, I'm going to kind of intertwine into that the results of an angler survey that we did to help guide some of these changes that we're proposing. So with that angler survey, this is something we do fairly regularly, and it's just an online survey. And what we did this year is we distributed it just online. We provided links to people through various social media outlets, press releases, and on our webpage. We basically solicited people to provide input onto our survey. This year's survey ran from May 11th through June 23rd of each year. I can't tell you the exact response rate for this year's survey, and some of that's related to how we distributed it by just providing a link for people to respond to. But we know we have a large enough sample to be really representative of the population. I'll go into that in more detail as we go through the actual regulation changes. But we know on average about 22% of people respond to our surveys. And what this survey really does is it provides us input on the regulation changes that we're proposing, and it just helps us gauge whether or not the public is supportive of what we're putting forward. So I'm going to go and talk about the specific regulation changes that we're proposing. I'm going to start with statewide changes, and then I'm going to start breaking it down by region. So the first statewide one is one where we asked anglers if they'd be supportive of us allowing porn to be used as bait on waters within Utah. So we posed that as a question in our angler survey. We had 3,210 people respond to that question, and 70% of them came back and said that they would support us allowing the use of porn within waters in the state of Utah. And 30% of them conversely came back and said they wouldn't be supportive. What really prompted us asking this question is when we looked nationwide at states that allowed the use of porn, what we found is Utah really kind of stood alone from other states. So what I'm showing here is just a map of the western part of the United States, and all the blue states are states that allow anglers to use porn, and there's one white state on there, and that's obviously Utah, and that's the only state in the western part of the United States that doesn't allow the use of porn. So what we can see based on our angler survey is there is really a high demand for the use of porn among anglers here within Utah. And I think it's pretty easy to see why there is such a high demand for the use of porn. It's really because porn is inexpensive, it's easy to obtain, it's easy to use, it doesn't smell, it's great for kids, etc. So we can see why it's popular among anglers. But the real concern that a lot of people have with porn is associated with people using porn as chum and littering associated with porn. So that's a concern that we had as a division. It's a concern that we acknowledge that a lot of the public have. We do know from talking to other states that other states don't really see a problem with this. This was a problem that we saw in Utah. There was one point in time, a number of years back, when porn was legal, and we made it illegal as a result. But other states aren't having issues. We see it's popular among anglers. So as a result of that, we're actually open to testing porn out again here in Utah. So what we're proposing is actually just a pilot study where we're going into each region within the state and we're asking our biologists to select one kokanee water and one carp water within each region, and we're allowed to use the corn on those waters. The reason we selected kokanee salmon and carp waters is because corn is a very popular bait for those two species. And our whole idea is we're going to spend the next 2 years on these waters just evaluating use of corn, and we're going to work with our law enforcement officials and basically just determine whether some of those issues that are associated with corn, so chumming and littering, are really popping up after we make corn legal, or if they're not really an issue. And our plan is we'll revisit the issue here in a couple of years and decide whether we're going to expand the use of corn, completely make corn illegal again, or just keep using corn in the same waters that we're going forward with right now. So the waters we're proposing are Cutler Reservoir, Deer Creek Reservoir, Electric Lake, Fish Lake, Flaming Gorge Reservoir, Lake Powell, State Line Reservoir, and Utah Lake. Okay, so that's it for statewide changes that we're proposing. Now I'm going to switch and talk about specific regions. And the first region I'm going to talk about is the Northeast region. So we asked a question on the angler survey to see if anglers would be supportive of us allowing burbot to be used as cut bait at Flaming Gorge Reservoir. We had 3,699 people respond to the question, and 72% of them came back and said they would be supportive of allowing burbot to be used as cut bait at Flaming Gorge. 7% said they wouldn't be supportive, and the remaining 21% said they were basically indifferent on whether or not we allowed burbot to be used as cut bait or not. In a similar question, we asked whether people would be supportive of us allowing perch parts to be used as legal bait at both Big Sandwash and Red Fleet reservoirs. We had 3,704 people respond to this question, and 65% of them came back and said they would be supportive of us allowing perch parts to be used as bait at those two reservoirs. 9% said no, and the remaining 26% said they were indifferent whether or not we changed that regulation or not. So based on the results of the angler survey to those two questions, we're proposing to add burbot to the list of available cut baits at Flaming Gorge Reservoir, and to add yellow perch eyes and parts as available baits at both Big Sandwash and Red Fleet reservoirs. Now also in the Northeast region, we asked anglers, would they support a regulation change at Brough Reservoir, allowing the standard statewide limit of 4 trout and any legal bait to be used at that reservoir? The current regulation of Brough Reservoir is anglers may harvest only one fish that's over 22 inches in length, and they have to use artificial flies and lures. So we're kind of managing Brough as a trophy trout fishery. Turns out it's not really functioning as a trophy trout fishery, and anglers aren't really harvesting a lot of fish from that water. So based on that, we're looking at just changing the regulation and going with our standard trout regulation of Brough Reservoir. So we had 3,698 people respond to this question, and 72% of them came back and said they would be supportive of us changing the regulation of Brough Reservoir to our standard trout limit. 6% said no, and 22% said they were indifferent whether or not we change the regulation of Brough Reservoir. So based on that, we're proposing to change the regulation at Brough Reservoir to a 4 trout possession limit with all legal baits being permitted at that water body. Okay, so now I'm going to shift gears and talk about the southern region. So in the southern region, we asked a question whether anglers would support a brook trout limit of 16 fish on Donkey Lake on the Boulder Mountains. The reason for this is the current limit's 4 fish. Turns out on Donkey Lake, it's a very, very dense population. There's a lot of brook trout in that water. They're not growing well, they're overpopulated. So we're looking at providing anglers an opportunity to harvest more fish to thin the population, to help reduce the competition among fish, and help promote growth and increase the size of fish that anglers catch. So we had 3,700 people respond to this question, and 76% of them came back and said they would be supportive of us increasing the possession limit to 16 brook trout on Donkey Lake. 5% said no, and 19% said they had no preference on whether or not we change the regulation or not on Donkey Lake. Now also in the southern region, we have 3 lakes in the Monroe Mountains that experience frequent winter kills of stock trout. And we were actually asked by anglers to first explore the opportunity of increasing the possession limit on trout in those 3 waters that provide anglers basically an opportunity to catch those trout before they die through winter kill each winter. So we basically asked anglers, would they support changing the rainbow trout limit to 8 fish from the 4 fish it is currently between August 15th and December 31st of each year for the lakes on the list below? So we had 3,483 people respond to this question. The 3 lakes we were asking people about were Big Lake, Deep Lake, and Annabella Lake. And the choices we gave them were, yes, they'd be supportive of us increasing the limit to 8 trout between August 15th and December 31st of each year. No, they wouldn't be supportive. Or they were indifferent on whether or not we made that regulation change. So I'm showing the results here in this graph. What I'm doing is I'm breaking it down by the 3 lakes. So the top is for Annabella Lake, then the middle is Deep Lake, and then the bottom is Big Lake. And across the bottom are scales, just the number of people who responded with a certain response to our question. The blue bars represent people who said yes, they would support the regulation change. The orange bars represent people who said no, they wouldn't support the regulation change. And red represents people who had no preference. And what we found is for all 3 lakes, an overwhelming majority of people said yes, they would support the regulation change. So based on that, for the southern region, we're proposing on Donkey Lake to change the brook trout limit to 16 fish. And then on Big Lake, Deep Lake, and Annabella Lake, which are the 3 lakes I talked about in the last slide, increasing the possession limit on trout to 8 fish between August 15th and December 31st of each year. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the northern region. For the northern region, we're looking at removing a seasonal closure for Cold Springs Lake, which is also known as Honeyville Pond. Right now, that lake is closed to angling between January 1st and right before Memorial Day each year, so we're looking at dropping that seasonal closure. Also, we have a new pond at Smith Family Park in Far West, which is right next to Smith and Edwards, more or less, and we're looking at adding that to our list of community fishing waters within the state. Okay, the last region I'm going to talk about is the central region. We don't have any proposed regulation changes for the southeastern region, but in the central region, first off at Jordan L Reservoir, we're looking at changing the possession limit for bass at Jordan L from a 6 fish limit where you only keep 1 fish that's greater than 12 inches in length to a 6 fish limit with no size restrictions. So we basically posed that to anglers to see if they'd be supportive of us having a 6 fish limit with no size, or sorry, 6 fish limit with no size restrictions at Jordan L. We had 3,705 people respond to the question. 61% of them came back and said they would be supportive of that regulation change. 11% said no, and 28% said they had no preference on whether or not we change that regulation at Jordan L. So based on that, we're proposing to change the regulation at Jordan Owl to a 6-fish limit for smallmouth bass with no size restrictions, and also remove the fillet restriction for smallmouth at Jordan Owl. Also in the central region, we're proposing to extend the catch and kill regulation for northern pike from not just Utah Lake, but into the tributaries of Utah Lake as well. And then finally, we're looking at adding Riverfront Pond to a list of community fishing waters within the state. So that's really all I have for proposed regulation changes. Just to kind of wrap things up, I just want to mention that we are definitely looking toward the future in regulation changes that we might propose in our guidebook that's coming out here, not next year, but 2 years from now. So one thing that we did as part of this regulation survey that we put out this year is we gave anglers an opportunity just to provide us comments, so feedback. And what we're looking at is basically taking that feedback and seeing what we can do and see what kind of the hot button issues are so we can make future regulation changes or future regulation proposals within the division. So I'm kind of showing the results here. We had over 1,000 people give us feedback. And we kind of categorized all the feedback that we came up with, and we actually came up with about 125 or so different responses that people gave us. What I'm showing here are the 10 most popular responses that came back when we gave people the opportunities to speak their own mind and respond and tell us how they think we're doing. So what I'm showing in this graph are those 10 responses and the percentage of people who came back and gave us those particular responses. So what we see is about 17% of anglers told us that they thought we were doing a good job and encouraged us to keep up the good work. About 15% wanted us to increase trout limits in the state. About 12% wanted us to improve bass management in the state. Right around 10% of anglers wanted us to increase our enforcement on waters and make sure regulations are being kept. Right about 10% wanted more fly and lure only regulations within the state. About 8% wanted us to increase species diversity. Another about 8% wanted us to increase access to private waters. Right around 6 or 7% wanted us to remove slot limits. About 6% or so wanted us to improve our community fisheries, and another 6% or so wanted us to fix Schofield Reservoir. So just based on that, we realized that these are kind of common issues that anglers are talking to us about and that they want us to see change. So as we move forward and propose our next guidebook here in a couple years, we're probably going to see some movement on some of these fronts to address some of these concerns that anglers have. So I just want to thank you for your time. One thing I do want to say is that really all the regulation changes that we put forward are vetted by the public, and really what we're trying to do is listen to the public. What we recognize within the division is the fisheries themselves, that's a public resource, and us as biologists try to manage that resource. So we definitely want to hear what the public has to say about the fisheries we manage. So we encourage people to basically share their ideas with the division by June 15th of each year, or they can share ideas with their regional managers or come to RAC meetings to share their ideas. And also we have a number of opportunities where people can provide feedback to us through either emailing, writing us letters, or through a survey on a webpage. So that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Randy. Board, have any questions on the presentation? Ken?
A couple of questions. On these limits that we increase in the fall and for Bruff Reservoir from 1 to 4 fish, those will also include a 2-day possession limit, am I correct?
It should be, because that's standard statewide for at least that water body.
And second of all, on kokanee and corn, I mentioned that kokanee fishermen wanted corn. Aren't kokanee zooplankton eaters? They don't eat corn? I mean, they'll occasionally take something, just like they do when you're trolling for them, because they get ticked off, but...
I believe what most kokanee anglers are doing is they're tipping their bait. They're trolling or something like that, and they're using it to help encourage a strike or get the fish to stay on their lure.
Well, okay, I'm not really 100% sold on the kokanee fishermen wanting corn. I don't know if it would increase, I don't think it would make a difference at all on fishing. I think it's just an excuse to get chumming back into the state. That's my opinion.
Yeah, Ken, I agree 100%. I've fished for kokanee for many, 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 many years, and
you know, the unique thing about corn is that it's yellow. You know, and I just, you know, once you put a kernel of corn in the water for a couple of seconds, I mean, you know, anything there is, I don't know. I just, I'm with them. I don't see any practicality to that relative to kokanee. I think that we can use bright yellow things very well to catch kokanee. I agree. I don't think it'll make any difference whatsoever. However, I think it makes a huge difference, and I've mentioned with the Utah Anglers Coalition, I've mentioned that corn is almost my go-to, was my go-to bait for carp. They are vegetarian, omnivorous kind of critters, and boy, you want to catch carp, especially if you chum, right? And so that is an issue, but in most carp waters, Utah Lake, or the duck clubs out west, or, you know, I mean, that's not really an issue at all. I don't see that's an issue at all. I do believe, however, that when I was younger, I would see a rainbow trout in particular just packed with corn. They couldn't even pass it. They couldn't even get it out of the digestive systems because, just like a baby, I mean, they couldn't digest that hard shell around the, you know, and so they'd just pack them up, and these fish would be all distended, and so... My main concern is that using corn in salmonid type waters, we're just going backwards, not forwards. But on the other hand, you know, my go-to bait for common carp is sweet corn. So, and then I had one other question, and that was relative to the two-year guide. I entirely support that. You know, you guys have done such a great job over the years of dealing with all of these issues, that it seems like publishing a new guide every year just costs us a little bit extra money to retool it. And so are we saving any money?
I think that's the hope, is to save some money on it. By putting out less, probably we'll find that, you know, some people will have to renew it every year. They could keep the same guidebook for a couple of years. I think
right,
long term it's going to save us some money.
Be,
I think some of this money saving too is internal. It's a little less on our end each year, revising the guidebook and printing it, things like that.
And of course, the director always has the flexibility of imposing, you know, catch and kill or whatever radical thing that needs to happen in the interim, right?
That's right. So if we have emergency changes, we have means of imposing those through, yeah, you know, emergency actions to the director's office.
Okay, that's all. That's great. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Carl.
I remember fishing with corn when I was a young kid, young angler, and is it really just a social change, or was there a biological reason to eliminate that corn? Was it really littering and chumming, or was there? I mean, I heard it, they couldn't digest it, you know, all those things.
I think we've heard all that. The science says now that it's not necessarily a digestive issue. I don't know if they digest it well, but it doesn't harden the fish. A lot of it, I think, was social, with chumming issues, littering, etc. That's what prompted the change in the past. I think from talking to other states, it seems like they're not having the problems they used to, so I think maybe society's changed a little bit. We might see less issues with chumming and stuff like that than we've seen in the past. And that's why we're open to giving this two-year thing a try, just to see if you know, we don't have the issues that we've had in the past with corn.
I just have a couple comments. One, in regards to corn, I'm sure that the agriculture people really appreciate you pushing that forward for them. It's another way of helping sportsmen, helping them out a little. I don't really have an opinion one way or the other on that. If people are going to chum, they'll chum with everything they have, so it doesn't make a difference. The other question on Donkey Lake, is that the one we're going to the 16?
Yeah.
Are we to assume that by raising the limits that eventually we'll break that back down because there's so many fish fighting for the same amount of food, and that the fish will actually maybe grow bigger, or is it just that they're just kind of stunted in that lake no matter what?
They are stunted in that lake, but that's probably related to overcrowding and just having too many mouths to feed, more or less,
right,
within that lake. So, yeah, we're hoping that by, you know, increasing that limit, we're promoting people within the population and just reduce the mouths and promote the growth among everybody else.
Perfect. That's what I thought.
Chris. Mr. Chairman, I have a question. So as part of the action items tonight, we have some state rule changes, but we also have some region-specific changes. Are we actioning only the central region?
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify. It was good to hear the rest of it. I just want to make sure. I did have one other question that wasn't asked. So on the Monroe Lakes, well, we're going to do additional harvest because we see some winter kill there. Is the harvest, do we know if the harvest is going to be additive to the winter kill? So you're going to experience the winter kill anyway, but yeah. We're also harvesting more fish. Is that a possible scenario?
Well, in those lakes, all the fish die every winter.
Okay.
So we're just all providing right. An opportunity to remove them before
okay.
They die.
Okay, I just wanted to check and see if there was some winter kill.
So yeah, it's not additive.
They don't always die. I have a cabin right there. And when they litter over, they're pretty big.
On the drought season, the cold, warmer seasons.
But normally, yeah, I agree, they pretty much are toast.
Okay. All right, I'm just checking.
You know, he's not telling you.
Thanks for the tip.
Very noble. They're on the sheet.
Any other questions?
Yeah, can I stay in your cabin?
No.
Just
okay, any questions from the public? Okay. I have two comments, cards that are kind of related to this. This probably would be the best time to maybe take care of this. Some of it is not specific to your presentation, but I think we need to hear from them. So thank you, Randy. We have Doug Cloward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I represent the Homeowners Association of Aspen Cove, Schofield West, Mountain Home, and Schofield Mountain communities. I'm here to request a consideration by the board and recommendation from the RAC to treat immediately, as soon as that can be done, the Schofield Reservoir. The problem starting in 2006 has continued to escalate. The current system of predation to clean up the chubs in the reservoir has proven not to be effective. We've had a group of us who have participated in the last several gillnet studies. We've had meetings and had the folks down in the southeast region come and speak with us. And we watch continually as they bring load after load after load of fish in, and the pelicans come in and immediately gobble up that resource. It has been an obvious failure in terms of being able to remove the population. They tell us that the population is a 20-year lifespan on those chubs, and it would take an 8 to 10-pound trout, either the tigers or the cutthroats, to take those fish on. And that process of trying to put in tigers has failed. They're not showing up in the gillnet study, particularly those who have been put in the last 2 years. So we're requesting that there be a change of attitude and direction to have a treatment on that reservoir now that it's the lowest that it's been in recent history. Be a perfect time budgetarily for us to treat that reservoir and turn it back into to the rainbow trout fishery, family fishery that it's been throughout most of the lifetime. I'm here tonight in the central region requesting that assistance. I'll be down on the 14th in the southeastern region. But the reality is the bulk of those who fish Schofield Reservoir, or who used to fish it because they don't anymore, are those from the central region, from Provo Orem kind of area. I've lived there on the reservoir for the last 15 years. I see it every day. I watch the fishermen, or the lack of fishermen who are there. I speak with the wardens. I speak with the fishermen. It's become a travesty that we've allowed that fishery to get to its current position. Please put support behind trotenoning that water and returning it to the fishery that my children and grandchildren will return. It's affecting property values negatively and business there in that small community. It feels like it's a forgotten resource to the state, to the fishermen of the state of Utah. Thank you.
Thank you. There's someone in the division that could give us a little bit of information on that Schofield situation. Appreciate it.
We had an algae bloom on Schofield Reservoir this last week. It killed a lot of chubs. It killed some mammals, some bats, raccoons, so on and so forth. Anything that drank the water really had issues down there. I sympathize with you. We are looking into it. I talked to Justin and Calvin, and we talked about the algal bloom and the fish death down there, and looked at it as an opportunity to evaluate the management of Schofield this fall. They're going to go in, do their fall gill netting, and at the conclusion of that gill netting, depending on what we see, we're going to make a decision on where to go with it.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Chris. So if we're to treat that, what would the implications be? How long would it take to recover that water if it were treated?
Fairly short. We can get it back up and going. Most times in most fisheries we treat, it's back up and fishable to fishermen within a year. The problem is cost, honestly. It's a pretty short window for us to come up with, $150,000, $200,000, $300,000 mid-budget year to treat Schofield. But it is something that if we sit down, because we are going to involve the anglers, and I'd like your contact information, and we'd like to sit down with the anglers and discuss the future of Schofield and what it takes to get anglers back there and work into this.
But it does sound like perhaps if something, if it were budgeted for, we could perhaps address it for the next year or something along, whenever it's properly treated.
These types of treatments, if big reservoirs are a fall effort, because you want to see that water as low as possible to reduce costs, have the temperature as high as possible, before it cools down in the fall. It's definitely a fall effort.
So Drew, so money's one thing, but availability of rubdown.
We have, and this is the other thing that we'd have to talk about internally. There's other rotenone treatments that are on the books, ready to be treated. We accumulate rotenone annually for efforts that are a year out, and we have a couple of those right now, and it would just be an internal decision on how that rotenone is spent, essentially, because Schofield Reservoir is a very important fishery, but we also have lakes like Pelican Lake and some of these others that need treatments too, so we'd have to evaluate the cost and priorities within the state, but it's definitely something that we'd like to discuss with the anglers.
I'm going to say, it sounds like a great use of Expo money.
Yeah, I was going to say, if some of the Expo money was still available and hasn't been committed, that might be a good resource. I encourage the division to look into that and see if they can get that.
Thank you. We'd make like you to make note of that and see if you can help us get our hands on some of that money.
Great project, great. I've got a question, and I'm sorry, what was Colin's name? I'm sorry, what was your name?
Doug.
Doug. Would you see a major concern with, and I understand the long-term prospects look very bright in that scenario, but for the year or so that the lake is virtually empty, would the economic impact be too significant during that year? Have you looked at that or thought of that?
It has been so bad and getting worse. The property values have gone plummeting. The ability to sell lots, there are cabin sites or existing cabins, has fallen off. I retired there, built a large cabin right above the reservoir. My children and grandchildren don't even want to come anymore because no one wants to fish there. When they had the slot limit where you could catch one over 22 and the ones that are between, it really meant, because there are no rainbows. There are none. In the last couple of gill net studies, I think we got one or two, period. So when you go there, the most fish you really could catch would be one, because you could only get one rainbow, or you could get three of the rainbows the right size, only one over the slot limit of the 22. So no one wants to fish there anymore. There may be three or four people who like to come and use a hold shove to try and catch a trophy tiger, but that's all there is. I'm telling you, there is no one fishing that reservoir.
So you're saying that in that
it's already so bad that if there is any resource of availability of the product and of budget, we've been told over and over and over again that it's budget and disposition of the board to allocate the budget to treat the water, and that's why I say that for most of us, it feels like it's lost and forgotten.
I was going to say one thing is that that's one of the waters my grandfather took me 45 years ago to, so I'm very familiar with Schofield and have great memories of when there were drought.
Yeah.
So I do understand what it used to be like,
it was always best to fish when the ice was coming off. So I have some great memories of Schofield, but I would agree that we need to do something with that. That's a great resource that we can't allow to go away.
And it was brought up during the comments as well,
right?
The survey.
In the top 10. Huh?
Yeah. I was just kind of wondering if this, really that's kind of a division decision. It's not something that going through a RAC process or even the Wildlife Board. I think the division could.
When I talked to Justin about it, when we were doing the gillnet studies, and we had a fisherman's meeting in my home about 40 of them there, and they came, and Justin addressed us. Great guy, appreciate the work that he's doing. And he frankly said, Doug, what you've got to do is get to the RAC meetings, because all we do is follow the policy. We don't make the decisions.
Yeah,
again, it's a budget issue, so go
yeah,
and
speak. As far as, yeah, I agree. You need to come and express that at the RAC, because that gets it out in the open. It gets things moving. The division, I think, is the ones that have to make that decision as to when that might happen, or if that's something that they want to spend that resource on. So we really appreciate you coming and bringing this to light. And
I was going to say, Doug, I'll write a letter to the director for you, too.
Appreciate that. We've got Chairman, Representative Hinken, that is also being bombarded with support requests.
I'm curious as a RAC, though, if we couldn't, if it's a police the RAC and we got the proper motion of votes, if we couldn't make a suggestion to the board to maybe make this an agenda item or something along those lines for future discussion.
Is it within the RACs and the boards to make the final decision, or is it up to the division and the funds?
I think that we can make a recommendation.
We can make a recommendation.
Proposal, and then it would be up to them, is the way I understand.
Yeah, I agree.
The biologist would make that determination.
So, Drew, is that something that you've thought about? Is treating it if the Rotenone was available? And I mean, I understand how expensive it is and everything. And I know it's been on a docket for a while as to both ways about Schofield, and I understand the way it's working now with the tigers and the cuts, but it's true what Doug's saying is it does suck, and there's nobody really fishing it.
He's right. There's the discussion I have with Justin is there's no better time to discuss Schofield's future than right now, because we have a lot fewer chubs in the system than we did a week ago. So it opens up a whole bunch of doors for us from a management perspective, going down the road. But we need to engage the anglers and see what they want in the future. I think everybody knows there are reservoirs in Utah that we treat every 9 years because of chubs. And you got to know that if we treat it, that's not the end-all be-all of managing Schofield. There has to be a management plan behind it that actually drives it to the future so we don't have to treat it again. And I've heard several times that we wanted to go back to a rainbow trout fishery. That's all good and well, except for in 9 years we're going to be having the same discussion about treating Schofield again. And we're not going to have $300,000 in our pocket to treat Schofield nine years from now and then another 9 years from that. We have to actually come up with a management plan that addresses the chubs. Now that could be rainbow trout, and probably will be. We have a number of fisheries down in the southern region that we're managing with rainbow trout continuously that are doing really well. Those we used to treat about every 9 years. Paiute, Otter Creek, Minersville, those reservoirs were the same issue. We added hybrid striped bass, which are really effective predator on Utah chubs. And those two fish, rainbow trout and hybrid striped bass, get along quite well. One takes care of the competition for rainbow trout and then allows the rainbow trout to grow quite big. And it's a pretty good management scenario. And that's why I think it's important for us to sit down with the anglers and really discuss, a long-term solution to Schofield that involves rainbow trout and a management strategy that doesn't put us in this situation again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Just one comment on that.
Come up to the mic.
One comment on that. We had that same conversation with a group of fishermen with Justin and the group. The response, we explored the idea of putting walleyes in there, putting several predator types that would be more aggressive on the fish. And his comeback was, we have so much pressure against us for anything with teeth getting into the Price River and downstream into the Colorado River that they didn't want to fight that battle. And that sounded ridiculous to us when there's already fish with teeth in it on the south end of the Colorado River coming up. So it felt like, frankly, run from the fight. I'm just telling you that there was a tremendous amount of frustration over the attitude of what else could be done to manage the fishery. We agree that there needs to be a slot limit. If they would do just what they're doing right now after they treated it, that would be a major move forward to give us longevity on that water.
However, you know, there's a huge difference between a sterile fish like a wiper, as Drew was suggesting, and other predators that can reproduce. And so that becomes far less of an issue downstream in the Price River. So.
Agreed.
Doug, I just want you to know that I've been quite involved in the fishing in the state of Utah for the last 6 or 7 years. And I understand some of the things, but you got to, and I'm not trying to make excuses for anything, but I have watched how the federal government says, you can't put this fish in here because of where the water ends up downstream, like Lake Powell, and yet Lake Powell's full of walleye, but we can't put walleye in the upper waters that drain down into Lake Powell. So the federal government rules a lot on this too. I just want to bring that to your attention, not trying to make an excuse for anything.
I appreciate that so much. I just think that the Utah state government is smarter than the federal government.
They are smarter, but they do have their hands tied. And I sat and watched it. But I agree with you, Doug. Something has to be done up there.
Hey, any other? Richard, I think I'd like to entertain a motion. I think there's a lot of issues associated with the treatment, et cetera, and I don't think you can solve that tonight.
We've still got another comment card around the public comment.
It really does not relate to this. I'd like to do that after.
Doesn't relate to the fishing? Yeah.
But it does relate to fishing, but not particular to the disposal.
Well, shouldn't we hear all public comment concerning the fishing presentation prior to moving to
the other one? This is I'm finding the one. Whatever the chair prefers.
I think I'll let you make your motion on this particular issue. This comment card is really a separate situation, and so we'll do that and then listen to that comment. So
I'd like to make a motion that the Wildlife Board consider convening a committee to address. Open up and address the management plan for Schofield Reservoir.
Okay. We have a motion?
I'll second it.
Second by Ron. Okay, all in favor? Five in favor, all opposed?
And the only reason I'm opposed is that we're voting on a non-agenda item that we've heard one person. So
I understand that.
All
this is to ask the Wildlife Board to do this, and we right. That's what we do.
Then it passes.
Okay.
And I would add to what Carl said, my reason for opposing is not that I'm opposed to that idea, but it sounds like from the division employees that have talked to us that those discussions are already happening.
I actually support what this gentleman is saying, and I actually support this carefully worded agenda or this motion. And I think it's very carefully worded, and I think it's okay. It's just I think it's a dangerous thing to do when one person comes in here on a non-agenda agenda.
But this board really has. I mean, that's what we do. We take public input, and then we can also make those motions and for whatever reason. So,
and it's part of the survey was relevant.
And I feel comfortable with it. That may not be Robert's rules, but I feel comfortable with it. We have one more comment on this issue. Is there any other comments on this? Barack on that. We have the William West.
West Street.
West Street. Okay. He'd like to have a comment on this.
Thank you, Chairman and Board, for letting me speak. I am William Lestrade from the Utah Fishing Outfitters and Guides Association. We would like to the board to think about a proposal of reinstating the one-day fishing license. We have found that most of our members and their clients come in for vacation, mostly to the Salt Lake area and Park City area, as opposed to the rest of the state. That's where the concentration is. But a lot of these people come in and families come in for vacation and fish one day for a half a day. They go out with a guide, whether on the reservoirs or in the rivers fly fishing. And now they're forced to buy a three-day license for 4 hours of fishing. And when it was the change, I mean, we understood when the change was done, we needed more revenue back then. But we have seen a decline in the number of trips where groups are picking different activities. They're doing different things. A lot of these people, like I said, it's more of an activity. They almost see the fishing license as like a baggage fee. You know, they're not used to being fishermen. They're not used to hunting. They don't know where those fees go to and the good they do. But especially for a family where the father is paying for all of his kids to go fishing, that fishing license fee can constitute about almost 15% of the total cost of the trip that they go out for their 4 hours. I think a lot of it is there could be some flexibility. A lot of it is just the perception. When they look and see that they have to buy a three-day license to go fishing for 4 hours, it just immediately turns them off. I think you could call it a one-day license and charge a good amount for it and keep the revenue coming in. And I think a lot of people would have would be pretty okay with that. We also, a lot of our members market to corporate groups and big conferences like dental associations. A lot of those pick the big hotels up in Park City. They may come with 300 to 400 people, and these groups will let their have a conference for 3 days, let's say, and then they'll let them pick a day they can go rafting, they can go mountain biking, they can go fishing. And some of these groups are, you know, 15 to 100 people sometimes. That cost of that license, the person putting those trips together, that is on their mind. You know, if it adds, it's a 100-person trip and it adds another $2,400 onto the cost of what their activity is that the company is paying for, that is a definite factor in what they do. We know that there's no way for us to really acknowledge how much business we have lost because of that. We send out quotes all the time, just like any contractor, and they may come back and say, okay, we'll go with you, or you may never hear from them again. You don't know why it was the license because of it, but it might not have been. It might have been some other factor that we don't know about. And I think you have this sheet. I'll kind of cut it a little short, but every other state around us has a one-day fishing license. They've always have. And when these big groups come in, they're usually with a consultant. Those travel consultants, they look in all the states. They look for the best deal for their customers. So they're looking, and you can, I'm not going to go through all this, but you know, you can see everything is kind of between $9 and $14 for a one-day. And we were there 3 years ago. We were right there one day, $12. And most of this, I'm kind of talking all non-resident. I don't think the resident fees are, you know, I think they're so fair for the residents of that. That's a good thing, I think, for the residents, like the three-day license. For the family going out Friday, Saturday, Sunday, that's a perfect thing. And I've talked to a few other people about how the licensing is going. They're seeing those 7-day licenses go to the 3-day because they're just going out for a weekend, but they need that extra day. A lot of it, too, I think, is just they're being taxed to death. People come in, we take advantage of the tourists. Well, I can't say take advantage, but we give them room tax, restaurant tax, transit tax. And like I said earlier, they look at that fishing license almost as an extra fee on what they're doing that day. And if they want to go mountain biking, that fee is not included. Like I said, I've had some talk. We talked with Tom Adams also, and I think the governor's office on tourism, they're going to start promoting more fishing. They're going to come up, they said, with a fishing website. And so I think part of that is trying to draw those tourists into the state. I mean, Colorado almost gets 3 times the visitor days that we do for fishing, and we have as good a rivers as they do. There's got to be a reason for that. We should be able to draw those people here. I just think a 1-day license would help that. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Any comments or questions from Rob?
I probably should know this, but I don't know the cost of our 3-day license.
It's $24.
For a non-resident.
Yeah, and the 1-day used to be $12. So they doubled the price of it. And like I said, I think a lot of it is just the perception. If you would call it a 1-day license again, I think you could make the revenue side work. You could have a lot of leeway in what you could charge for it.
This is probably a division question, but how many licenses do we sell to non-residents of the year? Do we have an idea? And how much did it fluctuate from the time we went from 1-day to 3-day?
This is spitballing from something I read about 3 months ago, but I'm going to say there's roughly 100,000 out-of-state licenses sold every year, and we, at least it looks like we are just under, so we did lose a few licenses, if I remember right. It was presented in the leadership team, Jason, or do you remember?
I wasn't in that leadership.
I actually talked to Kenny Johnson, who was his administrative section chief. He said that this year they're thinking they're going to sell about 86,000 licenses. Like I said, it's hard to say how many of those are affected by what we do.
Well, if you have a young family, it would probably be affected pretty good.
Well, that's what I mean. You're paying $120 to $125 for 4 hours of fishing. But. Yeah.
We are looking at the license schedule that came out. This 1-day was one of the ones we were going to go back and explore for the same reason you stated.
Yeah,
I can agree with you 100%. I guided for 5 years, but it was prior. You know, we did have 1-day licenses, and just again, like Mr. Cushing suggested, just spitballing, I think 50% of my clients were lone male on a business trip types, and probably wouldn't make much difference. But the other 50% were families or couples. That would A 3-day license would have killed that 50% of my income. I gave up anyway.
we actually do see that. If a group of guys comes out and is doing like an alumni thing or something, and everybody's paying for their own guide and their own fishing license, they don't care.
Yeah, right.
One guy is paying for all of them, That's when we kind of run into resistance.
Yeah, the exception was I had five Japanese fellows, none of them spoke English. I don't think money was an issue for them, but yeah.
Thank you.
Any other comments on that?
I got 2 questions. One is for the gentleman who was just speaking, or somebody heard the tone. What is an average day of kind of fishing costs?
For a family of four, once they do their fishing license and the guide fees and the taxes.
I'm not asking the tax, I'm saying if I...
If you just came by yourself, well, most guide services do it by number of people. So
sure.
If one person goes, it's like a private ski lesson. It's going to be a lot more expensive.
Sure.
You know, I mean, if two people go or three people, then kind of depends. So the price comes down with the number of people. So.
Sure. So what are those prices?
Everybody has their own price schedule, obviously, and some are a lot more expensive than the other. But like a one person trip is about $300 per person without the fishing license or gratuity. That's just the guide fee and the tax. Two people is like $170 per person, so $340, $360 with the tax. And three people, most guys charge between $150, so that's $450 plus tag, a little over $500.
Okay. All right. And then my next question is this something that we can entertain, or is this a legislative issue with the fee schedule?
Well, I think we can make any recommendation you like, or. But ultimately, the fee schedule has to be changed by the legislature.
The
board can still initiate that process, just as we spoke about on another issue. Sure. Right.
Yeah. Are you wanting to keep the 3-day and add an additional 1 day?
Yes, I think the 3-day, what we see for the residents, I think that's like is a good thing. But it's also for the resident, it's very cheap. I don't think it would make a difference if you kept the 3-day and the 7-day or however you wanted to do it for the resident. I think for the non-residents I think a lot of residents, Kenny told me that he just saw people for $30, they can get a year license. They just, you know, even if they just fished a couple days, they would get a combo license for $34. And he said they saw a lot of that 7-day license stuff go right. People just get a year license.
Well, I think you'll find the same thing even on non-residents if you have it at $15 or it's $24 for 3 days. Some guy go, well, maybe I'll fish the other days and buy it anyway. You know, but at least they have the option.
Yeah. And like I said, it's why do I have to buy a 3-day where I just was in Montana and I could buy a 1-day? As in Colorado, I can buy a 1-day.
Well, and typically what I found after 5 years is that these out-of-state people only had 1 day. Is that correct?
Yes. Designate 1 day for fishing and 1 day for going to the Olympic Park and
Yes, Chris. I've got a question for Chris. Actually, you mentioned that it was being addressed. Could you go into that a little bit more? Drew, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. I answered by pretty much anything.
Call doors, I'm sure.
Yeah, we changed the fee schedule a couple of years ago, and some things worked and some things didn't. And so we're going back in and looking at those price breaks. And I asked the question, which I talked to Ken about beforehand, why do we need a 1, 3, 5, 7 day license? Why couldn't you just, you know, charge by the day a lot like our neighboring states? It seems like, you know, in today's world, the computer age, and the point I made to the leadership team was, you know, we should be catering to our public and actually giving them what they want instead of force feeding them something. And, you know, it should be that you buy a 1 day license until you find that price break that fits for you and you buy a season license. And so that's what Kenny was going to look at.
So the trajectory on that, are you looking at making those changes for 2019? Because we're setting it to your guidebook? What?
It was so recent that I don't know where he's at with it, honestly. It was maybe a month ago is when we had that discussion. He was going to go back and look and then move forward with it. What that schedule is, I can't say.
Well, it sounds like the division is really already in front of this, so we appreciate that information. Thank you. Any other comments, any questions from the crowd? Okay, back to the original presentation by the board. Be open to any motion.
Hey, I've got something to say on that.
Okay.
Back on the comment. I would like to make a proposal, but I would like to make a proposal we accept everything the division has with the exception of corn. And I would like to see that limited to Flaming Gorge as a trial basis and Utah Lake as a trial basis. Flaming Gorge because Wyoming's doing it. Utah Lake because we need to get rid of the carp and it's full of carp. and see what happens and rest for a year and just see what happens before they go any farther with any of the other recommendations. So I would like to make that recommendation that we accept the proposal by the division with the exception of changing it to just Flaming Gorge and Utah Lake for the use of corn.
Okay.
Wilson?
Yes.
Is there a discussion doing it? I mean, would the same argument be for Lake Powell if Arizona was using it already and changed that to free water? I don't know.
Arizona and Utah, I believe, have settled on their plans together.
Arizona, corn is legal.
Okay, we have a motion. Any discussion?
Am I able to ask a question real quick?
Yes, go ahead.
So with the new guidebook, it's a two-year guidebook, will the new guidebook reflect the corn changes or these changes that are in here?
Yes.
So I guess what I'm getting at is just a one-year,
well, then I'll try.
Say 2 years.
I just want to see what happens using those two lakes. To see what happens, because one of them is heavy with corn, the other one's heavy with kokanee, and see what happens before we introduce these other lakes.
Okay, have a motion. Okay, motion dies for lack of a second.
Well, then I'll make a motion that we use three. We include Lake Powell, Flaming Gorge, and Utah Lake for the corn for the two-year period observation, and all of the other recommendations presented by the division.
Okay.
And I'll
all
second right. That.
New motion?
I'll second it.
And a second from Ken. Okay, all in favor?
Hold on. Can we discuss the motion?
Yeah, whoa.
could we see the slide to show the lakes that were being proposed for that?
Yeah, and Drew, not just that slide, but the y'all's rationale, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because
if I pass it, let me know.
I didn't.
All right. But so here's the rationale. So we asked the I don't know, there's roughly 4,000 people, Randy?
Yes.
And 70% supported the use of corn as bait. And this again is the states, us being the white middle there. And like we talked about, you guys, Wyoming and Arizona they do allow corn as bait. Now why? It is in demand, it's cheap, easy, and available. And chumming and littering, now I want to clarify one thing, both these things are already illegal. And so, you know, they are concerns, but it's the same with any kind of chumming and any kind of littering, which is why we'd like to use our law enforcement to evaluate this for 2 years. So this is, the study is to put together a list of waters, which we did, and we wanted kokanee and carp waters because those are the two species that are most sought after for corn. And I was telling somebody before this, I actually fished with a friend in Colorado, and he swore by his corn, this white, I don't know what kind of corn it was, but it was a white corn, and he soaked it in anise oil and something else. And he said, this is it, you know, this is the bait. I used that, and I used a maggot, and I couldn't tell the difference. So I find it hard to believe that this is going to be the end-all, be-all of baits, you know, if it is allowed. So what we'd do is we'd be using our law enforcement and their interactions with the public on this list of waters to determine whether chumming increases or stays the same, and then littering increases or stays the same. And so list of water is Cutler, Deer Creek, Electric Lake, Fish Lake, Flaming Gorge, Lake Powell, State Line, and Utah Lake.
So Ken, educate me here. So as I look at this, I'm only seeing eight waters here. Of all the waters we have in the state, it seems like a very small sample to me to begin with. And if we only tried it on two or three, it almost feels like it might be too small of a sample to try it on. I'm looking at every surrounding state is currently allowing it. Fishing is not my specialty, so educate me. What am I missing? What what do we know where we don't allow it, but other states do?
I don't know what the other states allow so much. I know this. And that took place, a can of corn you can buy in the store for 50 cents.
Sure, I...
You buy the other bait and it's going to cost you $3 or $4. You don't want to throw the other bait over the side of the boat because it costs a lot of money. But a can of corn is easy to open, pour over the side of the boat, and if once you can have it in your possession, which you cannot have now in a boat, you open the door to chumming, which is probably already going on, but it just more or less makes it a lot easier for somebody to chum, and they don't have to hide the evidence by sinking the can to the bottom of the lake.
So I see what you're saying. However, as was pointed out already, chumming is already illegal, and I am not a fan of creating new regulations to enforce laws that already exist.
And I understand that.
And so for that reason, I'm very comfortable with the limited number of waters that are being proposed. And I think the division has a good start here. I mean, the survey's shown a lot of support. Every state around us allows it. And as I said, the chumming's already illegal. So
yeah,
that's kind of where I'm at.
Okay, we have a motion, and they also have a second.
I'm still... the other thing that I like about the division's proposal is that the diversity in this small number of waters is really great. I mean, seriously, nobody fishes Cutler Reservoir for carp, especially. But everybody fishes Deer Creek. The yin-yangisms between, for instance, State Line Reservoir and Flaming Gorge, I mean, that's a huge stretch between a tiny little water that you could almost walk across and a huge reservoir. I think that will get us the kinds of information we need about everything from chumming to whatever that we need to move ahead. I agree with you.
Any other comments on the motion?
I would just add with them that I support the division's thing and would speak against limiting it more than what they already have.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Call for vote. All in favor of the motion? Okay, 2-4. All against? 5 against. Okay. Okay, I'll entertain a motion on the...
Well, we can go back to it, and I would make a motion that we accept the division's recommendations.
Okay, on the second?
I'll second that.
Okay, got a second on that? Okay, any discussion on the motion? Okay, all in favor? 6 in favor?
Opposed.
7?
6, I
am 1 opposed. 6 in favor, 1 opposed. Sorry. Okay, let's go on to the next item. Is an informational only. Riley, are you going to...
Mr. Chair, Riley needed to leave a little bit early. He's asked me to introduce Kevin Adamson with Utah Bowman's Association. Will be presenting our next informational item, talking about once-in-a-lifetime archery hunt strategies. And I'll just go ahead and turn it over to Kevin to introduce and discuss his presentation tonight. I think most of us probably have received that information, so go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, RAC members, thank you for your time, and thanks to the DWR. They actually met with us before this, and so we spent a little bit of time going through this proposal. Again, my name is Kevin Adamson. I'm a board member for Utah Bowman's Association, currently serving as the CFO for that organization. We have a proposal that is informational only, and so I'll present that if I can see the buttons to push here. there. Okay. Our proposal is, the purpose of it is to provide a once-in-a-lifetime archery-only hunt experience. Oh, wrong button. The proposal consists of this. There were a couple things that we knew we did not want to alter. So, currently, applicants can put in and apply for and hopefully draw a once-in-a-lifetime hunt opportunity. If you draw that permit, you can continue with option one, which is keep the permit as drawn. You hunt with your weapon of choice. That can either be a rifle, a muzzleloader, or archery. Our proposal is we do not want to alter that whatsoever. If the hunter chooses to continue with option one, perfect. Let them do that. They can walk out there with a muzzleloader on one shoulder and a rifle on another. Option two, this is what our proposal consists of. If that applicant draws that once-in-a-lifetime permit, we're proposing that they'll be able to exchange that permit for an archery-only permit. And we will have new dates associated with that hunt experience. For moose, these are the five once-in-a-lifetime species. Our proposal is to offer 7 days before the current season and 21 days after. The applicant cannot hunt during the current season. They've exchanged their permit for an archery-only permit. Bison, we're proposing 21 days before. Rocky Mountain goat is 10 days before, with 14 days that coincide with the current choice or current offering and 7 days afterwards. And for sheep, both desert and big Rocky Mountain, it would be 21 days after. Now, people are going to say, okay, how does that, you know, what would that do for the current season? If you look at the 2016 dates as they've been published and as hunts will exist, moose right now would be September 10th through September 16th would be 7 days before, and then October 21st through November 10th. Would be those 21 days after. Bison's an area where we knew we could not interfere on two areas that have rifle hunts, the Book Cliffs deer and the Henrys. We were, you know, as we discussed this and put our plan together, we did not want to interfere or have any conflict with rifle deer hunters on the Henry Mountains. So our proposal is that October 1st through October 21st would be that opportunity to hunt bison. Now, not all of the bison hunts, those dates line up the same as they did for moose. Moose is September 17th through October 20th. But on all the other species, each area can have a different hunt date. Rocky Mountain goat, September 1st through September 10th, 10 days, with 14 days coinciding at the end of those last current hunt dates with 7 days after. And bighorn sheep, we are not proposing a change to the Pine Valley or to Antelope Island. This would not take effect on there. There's also Pilot Mountain, which I'll get into a little bit more, where we know there are interstate agreements that we do not want to alter. Benefits of this proposal: provides an archery-only hunt experience. Hunters who choose option two would then decrease the number of people who are in field during the current offering, a little bit less pressure. And the one big thing that we knew we didn't want to change or alter is this does not affect the current draw process or the draw odds. It's only after that hunter has drawn the permit that they have that option to go choose an archery-only experience. Some discussion items that have come about through us sitting down as a board and talking, and also meeting with the DWR, Those hunters who may choose option two for sheep and other species, they would be made aware that there could be flying time. That's after the current hunt right now is when the aerial surveys are being conducted by the DWR. We would make, hunters would be made aware that those aerial surveys would be taking place. We also know there's road closures that happen on certain dates. No matter what the weather is like, road closures, you know, roads are closed based on Forest Service dates. And again, I said the interstate hunt agreement with Pilot Mountain in Nevada, we do not want to alter that at all, nor the Henry's or Bookcliffs deer hunt. The other thing that we've talked about is this could potentially affect the success rate on the hunts. We know, in talking with the DWR, they ideally would love to have 100% kill on each of these once in a lifetime, but really practicality manage it more to a 94 or a 95%. Our proposal, as stated earlier, is informational only. We would love to have feedback. Our plan is to present this at all RAC meetings and also present it to the board in the September board meeting. So, thank you.
Okay. I have a question. Would you propose that there would be a limited number that could actually choose that option?
No.
Two?
No.
How would that? So if there's 10 permits that are drawn under a limited entry scenario and they choose option two to go archery only, could all of them
all
go
of them
archery
could choose
only?
That. We would love that. As a member of the Utah Bowman's Association, that's what we're all about, promoting and perpetuating archery in the state of Utah. So if all 10 of them wanted to choose to do that, we welcome that.
I've got to comment on a little bias because I have 19 moose points. I'm not really excited about somebody getting out and going a week before or after I had my 20th year drawing it out and feel like I'm being strong-armed to go with a bow if I want to get out there before somebody else shoots the moose I've been targeting. You understand maybe where I'm coming from a little bit.
Absolutely.
And I understand I could care less how many days after the hunt you guys want to go, but I think it's when you start putting dates before other hunters after they've waited 20 years, I think there's going to be some negative feedback to that, even though I have harvested with a bow and I have a bow. But maybe that, I'm also fat and out of shape. So, I mean, sometimes I take a rifle a little bit more seriously, but I guess the point I was trying to make is the fact is that I know most of the hunts, the change was not as drastic as maybe I'm looking at the moose because I have so much invested in that. But the hardest part of a moose hunt is finding the moose. Other than that, it's really not a whole lot. You move in and you harvest your animal. But I guess the point I'm making that you really need an extra 28 days for that. You know, or a 28-day hunt.
Seven days ahead.
7 days before and then 21 after. And I realize if you're not hunting during the regular season now, that changes the dynamics a little bit as
right.
well. But I guess I was trying to figure out the reason why we needed to be 7 days earlier on the moose hunt if you did that.
So why did we, let me make sure I understand your question. Why did we choose 7 days early on the moose hunt?
Yeah. Right, so if I wanted to hunt earlier, then I had to hunt with my bow. Other than that, then people potentially who drew out as well could,
yeah.
you know.
I totally understand your question. I understand your situation. There's also probably people who have 20 points who can't wait to jump at this opportunity, who want to do it archery only.
I agree, but they have that same opportunity if you're a rifle hunter. If you drew that tag anyway, they can hunt with a bow.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is that it's any weapon. So it almost becomes an advantage to a bowman who drew that out because he can start a week earlier than anybody else who doesn't want to use a bow. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
And I understand that you're trying to get bow hunting opportunities. Don't get me wrong.
No,
I do hunt with a bow as well. So
great.
But I'm just trying to think of some negative feedback that might come from that from someone who's vested a lot of time into putting in. That they may come back and say, hey, you know what, I appreciate that, but you know.
Yeah. And so, you know what, thank you for your comment. That's exactly what we're hoping to gather is comments.
I think this is just informational.
This is informational.
I think everybody's open. I think they're in our next meeting, there could be somebody that says, I've put in for 20 years for moose, and
want to hunt it with my bow, and I don't want to be stalking it and be at 50 yards and have some guy dump it from 250 with a rifle. I'd like to have some days.
And so, I agree with that too. So I guess
so. I think there's arguments both ways for that, but I appreciate you, the Homeowners Association, bringing it forward. I think it's a unique opportunity for this that from a drawing standpoint doesn't affect anybody. There may be some twists and turns that will happen to this, but I believe that for a first viewing, this is an okay idea.
Rob, I understand your concerns. I do. I understand you have a thought and concern there. But I'll just throw out the question. With deer and elk, we have archery seasons before the other seasons. How would it be any different on moose than deer elk? What's different?
I would say the same thing. It really is different because you have the same opportunity. Let's face it, it's not a lot of moose tags. So, I mean, and you may never even run into this problem where you actually had someone hunting the same moose that was archery or rifle, but you might. But what I'm saying is that there's such a limited number of tags, you could be four canyons over. So, just a thought. I'm just throwing something out that could be perceived as something from somebody. I'm not trying to get away from archery opportunity either, because I understand that. Because I understand the other side of it, where you have people encroaching upon your archery hunts that have, you know, their limited entry hunts that are going out and scouting when you're set up, and you already have some of that problem going on already. So I get your understanding that you're trying to get, for lack of a better word, exclusivity where you hope to not have as many problems as you have currently. So I'm not against it. I'm just throwing out some objections.
I've noted it. Perfect.
Have you considered doing this as an archery only application right from the get-go and
be involved
in the bonus pool and the whole thing?
Absolutely. We've considered that. I think the biggest reason why we haven't, I'll just tell you, the biggest reason why we haven't done that is the implication of how that could change the draw odds. And I don't think, absolutely, I think that opens a big can of worms that the DWR is not ready to even address.
You know,
I've
been involved in discussions where there's a lot of people that want, you choose your hunt, period. You either hunt deer only or, you can't do elk too. I mean, there's a lot of things. So, but this is really good.
No,
something to think about.
That's another great comment. Thank you.
Any other comments on this?
My only comment is that, there really is a huge distinction between moose and all the others. I mean, once you found the animal, you just walk up and kill it with a rock.
But I say there are possibly not as much of the hunting ever required once you locate your animal.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
That's okay. I just had a couple of thoughts. I mean, at first glance, I mean, personally, I like to shoot my bow. I don't see any major issues with it. It would be interesting to take some public comment, but also get some input from members of the committees, the moose, the bison, and so on, as far as why that wasn't built into the model in the first place. Maybe it should be. Maybe it's time that it's built into a archery of some type, rather than any weapon season. The only other thing that I would add is looking at this at a glance, is with some of the species, we've got 7 days early plus 21 days late. It feels fairly complex.
So it is, and I'll give you a little bit of reason on why we did that. So, in our initial discussion, I sat down and had the opportunity to meet with three individuals from the DWR, and we went through each of the five species to look at the dates. Just like what Ron and the gentleman down here said, moose, so you don't need 20 days after, you need a few days before. The other one that was mentioned was sheep or goats. Goats are kind of the same way. And so we've talked a little bit about that. The feedback that we received was that most of the hunts for these once-in-a-lifetime species, The DWR really tries to plan that hunt around the rut because they want 100% kill. That's how the best way to manage that species. So if you look at bison, for example, we want to hunt that before because the feedback we received is once those guys are out there with a rifle, you're not going to find a bison. Yeah, your chances of killing one with a bow are non-existent.
Right.
Sheep. Right now, the current season dates end really before the rut kicks in for sheep. So that 21 days after the current hunt is prime opportunity. So Ron, my first, and I'll come back to you because, you know, I think the wording, please, I don't want to put words in your mouth, where you see this as an advantage for the archer. And my initial feedback was, I see it more as I'm leveling the playing field now. Because that's just me, so please don't.
I understand that. I think the opportunity would be great for archers in that first week.
I'm leveling the playing field because I'm not like, reaching out 300 or 400 yards.
It's a little bit of an easier target, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. So I get where you're coming from, and I understand having harvested a few animals with my bow. So it's not that I haven't used
it. No, I know.
So I guess the point I'm trying to say is the fact is I'm just trying to think of the other 344 people or whatever that have points above me or wherever we're at, what their feelings are going to be on it, the same subject.
We welcome them. But the reason we chose the areas we did is really to try to maximize that hunt opportunity for high success, because we know that it could potentially alter the success. Now, what that would mean to the DWR, I don't know. As a board, we've actually kicked around a couple ideas on things to propose that may not alter the success rate. So this is what we're happy with right now.
If they established an archery-only season for these once-in-a-lifetime things and make guys put in for them, just like you do
for all the other limited entry hunts.
Other limited entry, that would force archers, if that's really their passion, to take their chances.
The only problem with that is what we talked about before, you still have a big problem with the number of permits.
Yep.
And so then you're going to run into a smaller amount of people that want to do archery, so you're still the pressure on those. You may have a quicker way of drawing out for an archer that way. That could be advantage bowman on that, because you're going to have fewer people put into that. I guess the point of our look, and I'm not anti-success because I realize what it takes to get close to an animal and harvest an animal with your bow. I'm just thinking, I guess I'm looking at it from a different perspective, maybe because I'm biased. But at the same point in time, if there's only four permits in the whole area I'm in, I'm not sure how much you're really going to impact me anyway. So I'm just kind of just digesting it all.
Yeah.
And so I'm not anti by any means. So don't look at it from that standpoint. I was trying to bring up the devil's advocate on a little bit. So
that's what I asked for. So thank you.
Yeah, and you know where I was going, you know, for me, and I might be alone in this, you know, for me, I would, you know, having broken up dates, 7 days early plus 21 days late, I'd rather just have a consecutive.
Okay.
So it's just my call.
No, thank you.
Just as a little bit of clarification, explanation there, Chris, on some of those, that gets tough because, like, take Malco, for instance, was it a year or 2 years ago, we lengthened the seasons on the Malco, and in talking with Justin about the end dates that were chosen for the new lengthened seasons, they fluctuate. They're not the same on all units, and they fluctuate based on when the Forest Service closes roads. And so, and I'm just kind of picking one, right? Because now it goes one of those ones where it had a split season. And so the suggestion was, let's give 7 days, you know, before, because access is there, whereas afterwards it's, you know, it can be very minimal. Still are providing another opportunity there if somebody's
searching. No, I mean, it makes sense. I was just thinking out loud, like your other species, you stagger out the hunts. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think this road closure issue affects bear hunters in the spring with horses. So, yeah.
Yep.
So they have some limitations.
I've got a question for you just to throw it out there. What about the fact of just doing the extended archery after your moose hunt? You can hunt during the regular hunt, you get an extra 3 weeks afterwards if you want to use your bow. novel thought.
Great feedback. No, I that's, yeah.
But I mean, well, only the last 3 weeks, so if you want to go on your own, you're on your own. But you can still go out at the beginning of the season, so you're in the middle of the rut, too. So, I mean, you get the best of both worlds.
Well, and you're on to something there. I mean, I like the idea of just tagging on to the current season and just certain dates.
Kind of like extended arch we have.
So, yeah, the tough part with Moose and the feedback we received was, I don't know if I'm supposed to speak in the microphone, sorry. I kind of hate that. I'd rather stand over here. Moose, from what we heard with the species, is one of the species who actually sheds very early. We've been told that moose will shed their antlers even into November. So that's why, you know, we don't want to just have this. You don't want to go kill an animal and when it drops, the antlers fall off. So.
Yeah, but what I was proposing is that you get a hunt during the regular hunt anyway, and then you got an additional 3 weeks if you want to go archery if you haven't harvested your animal yet. I guess that's what I was looking at, is the fact is that you actually have a full archery-only extension for 3 weeks after the regular hunt, but they can still go out there on the opening day of the hunt as an archer.
So, Ron, is what I'm hearing you say that, I guess, a twist on the proposal, that rather than exchanging your tag for an archery-only tag, anybody that draws that tag, there's just a tip, there's...
Extended season.
An extended season that anybody with that who drew that tag could have that opportunity. Is that what I hear you say?
That would be probably what I would indicate, and also help the objective being 100% if you have another 3 weeks to hunt with your bow, if you did not.
So
depending on climate or whatever else went on, you just didn't get any moves.
So picking on moves.
I love to pick on moves.
So I'm moving to keep the regular season. What you're suggesting is keep the regular season as is. Add a 3 week archery on the extended season at the end of that. Anybody with that tag would have the option, could hunt during any one of those seasons with the given weapon. This is essentially what you're saying.
Exactly. If they haven't harvested yet.
So it's kind of like a dedicated hunter for once in a lifetime, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Almost.
I mean, I could even get behind a week early with the bow. Or you choose to take your bow out?
Yeah. Maybe rather than a dedicated hunter type comparison, similar to what maybe Wyoming does. You know, you draw a tag Wyoming.
Well, similar to what Utah used to do with elk.
Yeah.
If you drew a limited entry tag years ago with elk, you could spend $15 and go hunt 2 weeks early.
So would you be too opposed to, if they chose on their application to be able to hunt archery also? With that, would there be an additional cost for that tag? They do it to dedicated hunters now.
So we have actually discussed the possibility of exchange fees that the DWR may incur because of this. And we as a board for Utah Bowman's Association actually talked about the potential of offsetting or helping to offset some of those fees. So, but now what you're asking is, would we support, let me make sure I understand it, would we support, if they wanted to do this archery only, a $20 archery only extended hunt?
Well, on the original application, you indicate on there, okay, I wanted an archery extension with this too, I want to apply for that, and it costs you an extra $20 to do the for that application.
I think we're willing to look at those options. The one thing that we've tried very hard not to do is to change that process of drawing, because that's where the DWR will incur fees from Nevada. So now if all of a sudden if there's another checkbox down there when they apply for, would you be willing to fund $20 for this, you're probably just $10,000 right off the bat for a change to the draw system.
It's a reprogramming fee.
It's a program.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you could handle that pretty easily. Does it licensing is saying that you need to come in after the hunt and pay a $20.
And that's what we've just talked about.
Archery tag, the sticker that goes on the back of your tag, and you're good to go.
If you exchange that permit, could there be a fee, and do you pay for it right then? Absolutely.
Right, but I think you could do that just by coming for licensing and doing that versus
just change it to a dedicated 100 once in a lifetime species application. The Wildlife Board actually considered, or is going to consider as an action log item, doing a dedicated hunter for elk. Well, so it's I mean, it's the same.
So I'm probably getting a little ahead here. I've had discussions with Justin's concerning that dedicated hunter program. So we asked for that last year in the elk management plan. And the feedback that I've got from Justin is they don't want to do a dedicated hunter program for elk. And the reason why is that's exactly it, is projects. And so what they're looking at, well, this came through the last RAC, right? It was just a new fee schedule for a multi-season elk tag, but not a dedicated hunter elk tag.
Yeah.
It is, but there's more revenue.
More revenue, less oversight.
Less management.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you for that information.
Any other comments? I've probably taken more than I should.
I just one comment been running through my mind to do that, and the muzzleloader is going to come in and do the same thing.
Yeah, I thought about that too.
Yeah.
But you're back to your any weapon again. So
back to what you. I mean, yeah. The RAC wants to propose that the once in a lifetime go to weapon of choice. We're all in favor of that.
You're probably. Do really well if you this was for elk, because the division always wants to kill more elk. We're getting out of control right now. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, any other discussion with RAC would like to make? If not, I think we're done. I thought he did that. Okay, we better do the Jordan L. Okay. The Jordan L Reservoir Fishery Management Plan. Chris
Crockett.
You know, if you guys want to just go ahead and call it a night, we'll just you know, give me a few positive comments.
We can give you a quick motion.
You guys bear with me for just a second here. Okay, Mr. Chairman, Councilman, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. We had introductions briefly earlier, but my name is Chris Crockett. I'm the Regional Aquatics Manager there in the Springville office. I just want to take a few minutes to give you an update on the Jordan L Reservoir Fisheries Management Plan. Most of you are probably familiar with Jordan L, but just a quick overview kind of let you know the current conditions and some of the obstacles that we are currently facing. Jordan L is an impoundment off of the Provo River. It's in Wasatch County. Approximately 360,000 acre feet of storage with surface area of anywhere from 3,100 to 3,300 surface acres. Historically, it was managed as a two-tier fishery with rainbow trout and smallmouth bass. We do have quite a few other species within the system, including several sport fish species, illegally introduced yellow perch, and some native fish, Utah chub and Utah sucker. We have had quite a few challenges through the years. So the return to creel on our rainbows has steadily declined, and our gillnets follow that trend. So we're essentially seeing a lot of our rainbows not make it back to anglers. The catch rates of smallmouth bass have been increasing or stable, but those are all smaller fish. So we have a lot of smallmouth bass that are stacked up in that 6 to 12 inch range. So there's a lot of resources going to a lot of small fish and not much room for upward mobility, if you will, for larger smallmouth bass. Angler use has decreased dramatically from about 65 hours in 2003 to 12 hours in 2013. We also have just some of the basic issues associated with mid-elevation reservoirs, namely that it's a fishery that's not quite cold enough all the time for cold water species. It's not quite warm enough for warm water, so we kind of get marginal conditions for both of those. We have also had some issues in the past with reservoir fluctuation, as you can imagine, makes it hard on when it hits during spawning times, be it spring or fall, depending on whichever species you're interested in. That led us to ask some hard questions in an online survey in 2015. We had about 700 participants. Gathered a lot of good information. Basically, they came back and said they want to see some changes at Jordan L, see some new opportunities. That led us to create a working group in November of 2015. We had about 15 members of that group. Obviously, there's quite a few individuals there that represent DWR, but it's pretty heavily weighted with anglers. Those individuals either representing a specific species like trophy anglers for brown trout or tiger muskie, but also we had representatives from BASS, Blue Ribbon, Rocky Mountain Anglers, Trout Unlimited, Utah Anglers Coalition, and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. And I probably missed someone there, but I just want to drive home the fact that we had a lot of anglers participating in this, and they were really the driving force behind this management plan and deserve most of the credit that, and credit to Mike Slater for keeping us all in line. The purpose, pretty broad. We're just looking at trying to update the Jordan L. Reservoir Management Plan, something that's going to provide a quality fishery in future years. Our vision statements were refined. We're trying to attract individuals from the Ross Edge Front and beyond to enjoy family fishing and overall recreation at the state park, value trophy fishing opportunities, and also everyone's always interested in pursuing a diverse array of species with diverse fishing techniques. The group was able to draft a management plan and refine it down to 6 goals. I'll go through these and then circle back around, if you will, for a little more detail on them each. We were hoping to enrich trophy angling opportunities, promote a family fishery, ensure a quality recreational experience for fishermen and also boaters, manage Jordan L so it's compatible with their native species, sensitive species within a drainage. We'd like to get it back to being a destination fishery and ensure that no new species are illegally moved in or out of Jordan L. Taking a harder look at each of those goals just briefly, enriching trophy angling opportunities, we had 4 different objectives. First of all, we did need to increase the forage base. We're looking at that through several avenues. Objective 2, increase size structure of smallmouth bass. So again, this idea that right now we have a lot of individuals stacked up on the 6 to 12 inch side doesn't provide a lot of room for upward mobility, and that's a lot of resources going into small fish. A lot of the surveys, as well as individuals on our board, hammered home the fact that they would like to see an increase in smallmouth bass size. We do want to maintain our brown trout fishery. We have fairly low densities of brown trout, but they are large. It's a trophy fishing opportunity. And expand the fishery to include other predators, other apex predators. Goal number 2, promote a family fishery. We're looking at doing that through 4 different objectives. Increase opportunities for shoreline angling. Increase rainbow trout catch rates. So I briefly mentioned that we weren't seeing the return to creel as we have in past years. So we're looking at opportunities to increase catch rates, mostly based on the probably increasing the size of the rainbows that we stock. Objective 3, expand species for additional opportunities, and really trying to look at shoulder season opportunities, ice fishing, fall fishing opportunities, to help break down some of those potential conflicts that we've seen with fishermen and other recreationists or other boaters on the water. And as always, increase awareness of angling opportunities. Goal number 3, ensure a quality recreational experience for boaters and anglers. Anyone that's been on Jordan L at about 12 o'clock on Saturday knows that there's a lot of competition for space, and then we welcome those other individuals, but we are trying to look at ways that both temporally and spatially that we can reduce that competition. So that includes trying to promote a fishery that has fishing opportunities in the spring and the fall. Maybe if you get out there in the middle of December when it's frozen solid, you might not have so many jet skiers running circles around you. Objective 2, increase watchable wildlife opportunities. This opportunity will primarily focus on providing a wildlife watching opportunity with Kokanee Samp. Anyone that's been to Strawberry knows some of the opportunities that we could have on the Rock Cliff Arm up there on the state park if we're able to establish Kokanee Samp. Goal 4, manage the fishery for compatibility with native species management through reducing the risk of negative impacts on native species. A lot of that focuses on using sterile fish, so if there is an escapement downstream, that it's just a matter of 1 or 2 fish getting out and being done, as opposed to 1 or 2 fish getting out and establishing another reproductive population. Also, through just increasing the awareness of native species in the drainage. Native species are important to the division as well as the constituents, the angling groups. Goal number 5, manage Jordan L as a destination fishery by increasing the diversity of species that anglers can target. Most of the conversations thus far have gone towards tiger muskie, wipers, splake, kokanee. We're already taking some steps in that direction with some of the information that Jason provided earlier. We've already stocked 9,000 tiger muskie, 25,000 wipers, 60,000 kokanee, and we're just getting started. We also hope to reestablish the blue ribbon designation. Probably many of you are familiar with that. That will help with outreach. It helps with management guidance as well as funding opportunities. Sixth and final goal, ensure that no new species are illegally moved into Jordanelle. I alluded to yellow perch earlier. They were illegally introduced around 2003. We want to make sure that we don't have any other illegals come our way. And achieve compliance with aquatic invasive species. So again, we're talking illegal introduction of fish species, but we're also planning to keep quagga mussels and other AI species out of the reservoir. I'd be happy to take any questions or comments, but again, I want to acknowledge everyone that was on the working group. They really deserve all the credit. I came into the process fairly late, so I have the opportunity to speak to you about it today, but in reality, it was the anglers and the other individuals from DWR and state parks that deserve all the credit for making this happen. That being said, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Ken?
Two of them. First of all, to go back to the beginning, I wanted to congratulate Randy on his new position that he has with the division, and he's stepped into it with a fantastic effort and doing a great job. And Chris, being on that committee and listening to some of the setbacks that we might have on that committee as far as being able to implement the program, I just want to say thanks to you and your staff for being able to implement this program as early as you have and to be able to fulfill as much of it as you have so far and with the other stuff coming. I just want to tell you thanks for your efforts and what you've done.
Appreciate that, the region appreciates it, kid.
Yeah, Chris, maybe you can, because when you got to the family fishery part, it didn't seem like the definition of that family fishery was the classic Utah definition of a family fishery. Are you changing trying to change the definition of a family fishery with that by throwing, you know, watchable wildlife and diversity of species and all that?
I wouldn't say we're changing it. We are kind of going both the traditional route as well as introducing some new species. We've traditionally been stocking 8-inch rainbows. I think most people would agree that's kind of a family fishery rainbow. We're looking to shift those pounds over to 12-inch and track what we hope is going to be an increase to creel, so improve our rainbow fishery. We're also planning on stocking splake. It may not happen in 2017, but it will certainly happen in 2018. To again enhance the family fishery opportunity. And I probably glossed over that point kind of quickly, but we are looking to improve shoreline access and shoreline opportunities as well.
Okay, and then one follow up, you know, it seems like it, just from at a glance, and I wasn't involved, so sorry, it seemed at a glance that this was pretty predator heavy. And you know, and I was always taught that, you know, that a trophy fishery, this kind of, you know, knocks heads with family fishing opportunities. So you can have one or you can have the other, but to have them both at the same time becomes relatively challenging. So could you address that just a bit?
For sure, and you know, I believe that's a valid point. We are taking steps in the right direction to improve the forage base, kokanee salmon being one of the steps. Also, I alluded to the fact that we have a lot of smallmouth bass. They themselves will be a forage base for some of these predators. That is by design, because we would like to see some of those smaller year classes, you know, thinned, if you will, to provide increased resources for both wipers, tiger muskie, but also for the larger year classes of smallmouth bass. This upcoming year, we're going to be taking a hard look at our Utah chub population. We've seen a little bit of a decline in Utah chubs through the years, and everybody, you know, you have to remember Utah chubs are both good and bad. Those individuals can take over the system, but when they're in balance, they're also providing a lot of small Utah chub. We're a little bit concerned our Utah chubs are getting old, getting a little senescent, and not reproducing. We will be looking at that this year. And I'll just also throw in that a lot of the species that we're stocking up front spend the majority of the first 2 to 3 years eating zooplankton. We do have a very strong zooplankton community in the system, so we're hoping we'll be able to have a healthy population of those individuals before they shift over to piscivory. But admittedly, Danny, it's always a balancing act between a family fishery and a trophy fishery. But I think we're on the right road.
I had a couple of questions, and I don't know, maybe you can answer them too. But so I know you talked about the balancing act. Great segue. So I noticed one of the goals, ensure a quality recreational experience for boaters and anglers. I know that's become a very popular boating link. One of the strategies here is increased wakeless areas. If you've got a wakeless area too small, bouncing fishing boats off the cliffs, basically, if it's too big, then you significantly reduce the boating water. How do you determine where to draw that line?
I'll let Ken answer that
one. One of the things we did is we had a member of the Parks Department there. She manages Jordan Allen, and I believe the agreement was to move the buoys out so they'd be out almost a mile from where the river enters. They have moved the buoys out quite a ways. I fished it the other day, and it was on a Saturday afternoon, and we didn't have any, well, there's a lot of boaters out there in the middle on the way over, but once we got up into that arm, it wasn't bad at all for fishing. Lots of room for fishermen. So I think that was addressed. As far as the predator goes, that was addressed really hard, but you got to look at one thing. We got a real overabundance of smallmouth bass. They have to be thinned out. If we can get them thinned out, we get bigger smallmouth bass. And we're putting in predators that are sterile, so we can control them real easy. And I just think that there was a lot of thought that went into this for 6 months.
Sure.
And at 5 hours each meeting. And so I think that everything turned out on the right track.
Right.
I only got a few eggs thrown at me, so it was okay.
No, I was just curious, more out of curiosity's sake. And I've been on committees. Yeah, I know the investment, believe me, so kudos. But so you're talking moving a mile out. Where's it at now?
I don't know if it's at a mile or not. It's out quite a ways. I was up there about 3 weeks ago on a Saturday afternoon. Going from the launch ramp over into the arm was terrible because of the water skiers. But once we got into that arm and got up to where the buoys was, and it was still a long ways up to the river, it was pretty good.
Do you feel that it's increasing that is going to discourage boaters a bit, turn some boaters away, perhaps?
Now, I don't know if it's going to turn boaters away because the parking lot was full. I think it's just going to provide an extra place for the fishermen. And really, when you get up in that arm, I don't know what good it is to water ski anyway, because you've got the waves bouncing off the walls, creating a lot of wavy action. It would affect skiers.
I am hearing some concerns that we might need to reevaluate where they're currently at based on changing water levels. So that might be a tweak that we need to do in the future. And if I might, thank you, Ken, for reminding me. Yeah, in response to Danny's question, we are utilizing sterile predators, so we do have the flexibility for backing off or increasing harvest rates if we do see that there's an issue. And I should point out that we're going into this with fairly modest stocking rates per acre that will give us that opportunity to respond accordingly if we do see a deleterious impact from all the extra mouths.
Yeah, you'll be able to respond every 2 years.
Chris, what are the native species?
The native species in the reservoir, for the most part, we're just talking Utah sucker and Utah chub and some Bonneville cutthroat trout. The native species.
Oh, okay.
And browns.
German browns.
I think it's okay.
They were there before the lake was created.
Okay. I just wondered about that.
Any other questions or comments? Okay. I think we really are done.
In command.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Sir. Richard. Always a pleasure.
I think something like that.